the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. And I'm guessing if you're listening to us right now, you have multiple forms of identification. A driver's license or a state ID card, maybe a social security card, perhaps even a passport. But nearly 1 in 7 people around the world do not have identification. That's a billion people, many of them women, in lower-income countries. Without ID, they cannot open a bank account, get a loan to start a business, or even vote. And it's not a question of just visiting a government office. Many people are born without birth certificates, leading to lifelong problems in getting identification. Some call this the global identification crisis. This basic necessity of modern life is often overlooked, but it's a key part of making sure women in particular have equal access to services and opportunities, be it getting a job, opening a bank account, or enrolling in social assistance. All of this caught the attention of a young woman from Byron, Illinois, during a visit to her parents' home country of Kenya in 2019, and she came back home wanting to make a difference. Elizabeth Niamwanga is an inventor and lead programmer of Etana, a device and company that's meant to help solve the global identification crisis. And did I mention she's 17 years old? Here to talk more about her work, her studies on biometric data and gender, and how her freshman year is going at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is Elizabeth Niamwanga. Welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listeners, in order to make our schedules meet, we tape this conversation ahead of time, but we do love hearing from you about what we've been talking about. So email talk@21stshow.org. Again, talk@21stshow.org. All right. So, Elizabeth, how did you first hear about the global identification crisis?
Yeah, so my parents are originally from Kenya, which means my entire family still lives in Kenya. And before COVID, I was kind of back like in their village visiting my family. And my aunt owns a business, kind of like a little shop. And in Kenya, what they use for money or like any type of transaction, it's something called M-Pesa. And it's a digital type of transaction. And basically all money is kind of digitalized. And I remember there used to be other women in these shops like selling jewelry, selling different types of clothing, and they'd all have the M-Pesa numbers on the very front of their store. And basically whenever you want to pay, you go on your phone, you type in that M-Pesa number, and that's how you send money. And I remember there was one girl who I was sitting right by, and she would constantly have people approaching her asking to pay. Oh, can I use this? Can I buy this? And she would say, I don't have M-Pesa. I could only use cash. And a lot of people, obviously, even here, don't carry a lot of cash with them. So she was missing out on a lot of business. And it was pretty common. There were other women who had the exact same problem. They just didn't have M-Pesa. And to me, that was strange. That's like not having a bank account, essentially. And when I asked all of these women, the thing that they had in common is they had no form of ID, which means they had no like birth certificate. They had no driver's license. They had nothing. And when I asked them perhaps why they didn't get an ID, every single answer was a little bit different, but it had to do with cultural barriers. Sometimes a lot of it revolved around gender and kind of money. As they grew older, it just became harder, especially for women, to get different types of identification. And so I think like being in that environment, that helped me see exactly how important digital identification is and how many women just don't have it.
How did that make you feel? I mean, these are women, I guess some in your own family or at least in your own community or your family's community. How does that make you feel?
For me, at first, I will say I was a little confused because that's a problem I don't think I've ever really thought of before. In the U.S., it feels like everyone has some form of identification. If you're born, you have one. It's very easy to get one. And for me, it was a little confusing, I'll say, at first, because as they were explaining to me why they couldn't get identification, for example, in some areas, you need 2 men to verify that you are who you say you are before you get any type of identification. You have to go to like a tribe leader. And it's these really, really kind of corrupt cultural systems that hold women back simply on the basis of gender. So I was confused. And I also, you know, I think that kind of did have me start thinking, is there a way to kind of verify digital identification without having all of these different third parties in there? Because for a lot of these women, it wasn't that they didn't want to get one. It was that there were oftentimes like men or different social systems standing in between them getting identification. So definitely confusing, but I think that kind of is where like a little light bulb lit up. And I started thinking, how can you kind of remove the middleman and help them get identification just because, you know, they are who they say they are?
Well, that's what Etana is meant to solve then, right? So tell us about that. How does this work?
So the device itself, It works to basically give anyone in low infrastructure environments, there's an emphasis on women, but anyone in, where their areas like no electricity, no internet, types of digital identification. And the way that it works, it's like a little device. It kind of functions as like a deconstructed phone. And so let's say you use the device, you input your fingerprint, and it converts that into a hash. So it's very, very simple data, like a bunch of ones and zeros. And then the phone kind of works as like a 2G phone. Well, I guess Etana works as a 2G phone. So it has a SIM card and it sends all of that information to a blockchain through SMS, through messaging. And then once it gets to that public blockchain, it basically can reconvert back into like the biometric form it was in. You can enter all information associated with it. And that's how you can kind of store any type of digital identification in areas where there is no electricity, no internet, because it's solar panel powered. And a lot of these areas, even the very, very rural ones, have some form of 2G technology. It's just they have nothing past that. So that's essentially how it works.
Okay, I think I can wrap my brain around some of the things you said there. You're putting your fingerprint on, it's digitizing it into the string of numbers. It sends that over the internet or over the text message system, SMS, short message service, and it goes on to the blockchain where something something blockchain. Oh, we're going to maybe set that aside for now. I guess the big question I have is like identifications are the reason people trust them is that they usually have like a government stamp on it or something like that, right? So how, talk about bridging that gap. Like how, why will this get people access to bank accounts, for example, or the ability to vote?
But the thing about identification is that all you need to prove that you are who you say you are is some form of like biometric identifier. And that's this. I know the US doesn't use really digital identification as identification. We use it for other stuff. Let's say like you're on your phone, you're trying to open up an app that shows all of your bank information. It's kind of that same concept, but these countries, their identification systems work a little differently. So the entire goal of this, like in these countries where there are all of these cultural barriers that are making it really, really hard for women to get identification, you're just giving them a direct path to prove that they are who they say they are without kind of making them go to someone else and have them vouch for them or kind of bring third parties into the equation. Because whenever you bring another person in, that creates a different type of bias.
And it's something that they maintain control of. Okay, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we will have more in our conversation with Elizabeth Niamwanga, who is the inventor and lead programmer of Etana, which is something that she created, as we've been discussing, after visiting her parents' home village in Kenya. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
It's the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're going to continue my conversation with Elizabeth Niamwanga. She's an inventor and lead programmer of Etana, a device that is aiming to help solve the global identification crisis. This is where primarily women in lower income countries, for a variety of reasons, are not able to get identification and therefore are not able to vote or open a bank account or transact business. And this device is aiming to use technology that is available in these places, as well as the blockchain, to create a secure digital form of identification for people. Niamwanga is from Byron, Illinois, although her family is originally from Kenya. And did I mention she is 17 years old? She is a freshman at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I spoke with her earlier this week in order to accommodate her college schedule. If you want to let us know what you think about what we've been talking about, the email address is talk@21stshow.org. You know, a lot of people might have visited, had the visit you did, and thought, oh, this is really a shame. I'll see if I can raise money for a charity that's working on this. And you said, no, I'm going to see if I can invent a device and some software that will solve this problem. What is it about you? What do you understand about yourself that made you want to take this much more proactive approach than a lot of people might have?
Yeah, I think for me, I tell a lot of people that I attribute kind of the success of any of this to my age, because I was really young when I started working on it. I wouldn't say I was around 14 or 15 when I started seriously working on it. And I really didn't have like any specific limit in mind. I wasn't thinking, oh, I need to raise this much money. Oh, I have this type of timeline, the type of things that people usually do when they're creating tech startups. For me, I was just learning how to program. I was really, really getting involved in it. And this was always in the back of my head. And I was working on an app, and it basically was going to help like validate different types of identification, like using biometrics. And there are a lot of apps that I guess kind of like do that. And it was very, very simple. But as I was like talking more to my family at home, I was realizing there's absolutely no way that they could use an app I produce, because I'm making it for smartphones, I'm making it for Apple devices, Android devices, things that they don't really have access to. So that's when my mindset kind of shifted. That's when I started like applying for funding, and I started thinking, oh, I have the software for it. I wonder if I can make a device that's going to kind of carry this exact same concept, but work for the people that I've kind of had in mind while I'm developing this. And I think that one of the reasons that I kind of wanted to be a little more proactive with it is because I'd seen a lot of tech startups, I guess a lot that I've dealt with types of digital identification. And the problem for me was that I saw, like, regardless of what type of tech startup it was and what they were working on, they kept leaving women behind because they weren't putting them at the forefront of what they were designing and developing. Because even in Kenya, kind of anywhere you go, the barriers for women and men to get identification are very, very different, and much fewer women have identification in comparison to men. So I thought that kind of like by looking at that, and I was so close with these women already, so by including them in the design process, and this was kind of a fun project at first. So like working on it with them for fun and kind of just bouncing around my ideas and showing them what I had worked on. And that's kind of what I think made this what it is today, because the people that I was kind of hoping to create this for, they were so close to me during the entire time I was working on this. And I could see very, very clearly if this were to come to life, exactly how I would use and exactly how it would affect people. And I think that, like I said before, also my age was just very, very helpful, because I didn't think super logistically. I just kind of like moved really quickly. And then, you know, I started getting help as like the project went a little further along, but always kept in mind and kind of talked to the woman that I was hoping to develop this for and use this for.
How did you first get involved in the world of technology?
So I'm from Byron, Illinois, which is a really, really small town, kind of like west, northwest of Illinois. And then when I was in eighth grade, I applied to go to this kind of like STEM boarding school. It was this public school in Aurora, because I was interested in math purely. And
this is IMSA, Illinois Math and Science Academy.
Yes,
right?
Illinois Math and Science Academy. And so I had applied to go there. And that's where I took my very, very first computer science class. And I didn't like it that much when I first started it, because I didn't even really know what computer science was when I got there. And I felt really behind because my school was very small before. I didn't really know what was going on. But I found that the way that I really, really enjoyed like, you know, programming and being in that class was working on projects like this, like projects that I cared about and projects that I felt like, you know, maybe were overlooked or that affected me. So I think that's what made me really, really like computer science. Not necessarily that I absolutely love, 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 love programming, but I think that I see it more of like a method to kind of carry out ideas that I have that perhaps could help people. I feel like it's more so a way just to build these different types of projects that I feel like I'd had in my head before, but I just had no idea how to carry out. So that's why I started programming. After that class, I basically like learned everything else on my own, because I just, you know, I thought the concept was cool and I had ideas in my head of stuff I wanted to build. It was just a matter of like learning the programs and learning how to do it.
So you talked about applying for funding. What was that like? And I wonder if you found your age or anything else to be a barrier in that process.
Yeah, applying for funding. Truth be told, I didn't think I'd get any funding when I first started applying. I just needed really, really small amounts, because that's when I wanted to start prototyping. But people were very, very responsive to the idea because I think I just tried to explain exactly the problem it would be solving very, very well and how it impacts these women. And it's also a problem people don't really, think about until you explain it to them, like until you say, this is why women don't have identification, this is why they need it, and this is how we can give it to them. So I will say it's a really, really tedious process. But at the beginning, I think if you find the right type of places that are looking, to give you funding or looking to like fund ideas like this, they will be helpful. You just kind of have to scout out a little bit. And I will say my age also was a little kind of, it hindered me a little bit. But I do think that it also helped me a lot because I think having like this, that type of support system of people who looked at my age and thought, oh, this is cool. And she's doing it at this age. So maybe if they weren't giving me money, they would like share my story or they'd post somewhere about it. And I think that that also helped a lot. So even if I didn't have a lot of support, like in the form of money, I had a lot of like vocal support and I had a lot of people asking me, how can they help? Even like small types of donations, different things like that. So applying for big in big areas, maybe the age is a little bit of a hindrance, but I believe in any every other aspect, it kind of almost helped with like funding and outreach and things like that.
Yeah, there certainly is like a whoa, check this out. This young person is working on this major global issue aspect to it. I wonder if you have any stories. So have you've prototyped the device? Has it been put into place in the real world on like a pilot basis?
We've tested, I guess, like the basis of the software kind of in different places and see if it's didn't have tried to see if it worked. But we went to Kenya in December of 2022. That was just strictly a research pilot, though. So we were working with this other group, and we'd basically go into like these different environments and we'd talk to women without identification, and we would see exactly what their barriers were. Because the whole idea of this like entire device and working on this is to make it very, very, very gender responsive and very, very human responsive. So yeah, we kept like prototyping. We would go back, we'd ask them, oh, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Does this make sense? Does this make sense to you? We'd get all their input, we'd come back and we'd kind of like tweak it a little bit and see exactly what we wanted to do, what we wanted to change. But the basis of, I guess, like that pilot, which it wasn't a real pilot, it was more so a research pilot, was to see, let's say we were to take a device there right now, where would we want to put it? Like, where would be the best area to put it? Who would be the best woman to kind of help us like launch this? And how much education has to go also with launching this? Because we want these women to trust us and understand how this can help them, and also be excited about it as well. So that's kind of what we're working on right now, and kind of just making it the absolute best product it can be before we kind of let these women use it.
I wonder if there's a personal story or something that you encountered while you were doing this work there, from someone that, is maybe not what you expected, right? Or it's something that like really surprised you the most or something as you're trying to make this very, like you said, women first device, like that surprised you or that you hadn't thought of.
Yeah, there was, this is where I learned a lot about like the cultural barriers for women and identification, because obviously like I knew about them, but I hadn't really heard of too many stories firsthand. And I remember there was this one woman who I was talking to, and she was an orphan, so she just didn't have any type of identification because of that. But her brothers had all gotten different like IDs because they had their uncles basically verify, oh, you are who you say you are. You go to the tribal leader, you can get an ID. But the problem for her is that her family had land. And once you basically claim your identification, you get a plot of land. And all the men in her family said there's no reason for her to ha have a plot of land. And for that exact reason, they were refusing to verify her identification. And because of that, she couldn't work, she couldn't vote, she couldn't receive any healthcare services, just because they believed that there was really no reason for her to have that like small plot of land. Like it's something that I barely doubt would have impacted the whole entire family. And so I think things like that and seeing how minute it seems to some people who are just, not willing to compromise. And let's say they don't think women should have identification, they're not gonna like switch on that. I think it was just so interesting to see like how it varies from woman to woman. And a story like that, obviously, they're not thinking of how it truly can impact her, but she hasn't been able to work, she hasn't been able to vote, and it's all those things. Her life is kind of at a standstill because she's a citizen of this, like country or this society, but she doesn't have access to the rights that all of the rest of the citizens get. So I think that really opened up my eyes. That was just one woman I like very vividly remember talking to because I know in Kenya, you talk a lot about like land, your family owns land, everyone owns land. And so obviously that's just like how one example of how in other countries, you know, those cultural divides are so different as compared to the US.
How has your family reacted to your work on this?
My family has been really supportive. At the beginning, they didn't really know what I didn't really tell them what I was working on until I started getting funding for it, because then I needed kind of help. I was pretty young, so I needed help managing all of that. But they've all reacted really, really well. I think especially my parents, because I wasn't born in Kenya. Like my connection to Kenya is basically entirely through them. When we go back, like I'm going like to their home. And so I think they've definitely been very, very supportive of all of this, especially as I like have told them more about it. And especially my family back at home. I think that it gives them kind of like an example of almost like the American dream, I kind of want to say. Sometimes when I talk to my cousins about all of this, they don't know what computer science is. They don't know about these classes. They don't know about these type of things. And I think like for them, let's say for girls in like my old village, my cousins and all of their friends, I think it gives them like a type of inspiration kind of to see that this type of thing, like, you know, they can do it. They can see this type of problem and they can solve it using like basically STEM. So they've all been very, very supportive, like my family here, my family at home, and they're really, really like looking forward to seeing where this goes. And they've just been so helpful with it the past few years.
Where do you see your life and career? You're a freshman in college now. You've gotten a lot of attention for this work, and it's something you're still obviously very passionate about and working on. Where do you see yourself going with your life and career?
I'm studying applied math and computer science with like a minor concentration in econ. And I've always like wondered that, because going to college, I knew what I wanted to study, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I really, really like this type of work. I think even when I was in high school, there were other ideas I had around like digital identification, around banking, around education, and all how it pertains to gender and women that I was really, really, really interested in. And I always felt like, oh, there's probably a way I can use computer science or math or data science to kind of like evaluate or solve these problems. So I would hope after all of this, I like the idea of working in like social impact tech, different types of things like that, working on projects like these. And I think that there are a lot of really, really cool ways that you can use like computer science and math to solve problems that don't really seem related to computer science and math. And I think that that's what I want to keep doing, especially in how it pertains to gender and women and economic development, girls' education, different types of things like that. I feel like those are the big areas. And that's what I would want to like focus on or study and work with.
Elizabeth Niamwanga is the inventor and lead programmer of Etana. She's also a freshman at UNC Chapel Hill. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your work with us on the 21st show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is all the time we have for our program today. Be sure to join us tomorrow when we will have our regular reporter roundtables looking at local news around Illinois as well as the latest in politics. Plus, we'll have an interview with Melina Moye, who is one of the marquee artists at the El Nora Guitar Festival happening in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois this weekend. That's all coming up tomorrow on the 21st show. Our program is produced by Christine Hatfield and Kennedy Vincent and Jose Zapata. Our intern is Nick Boyven. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Visit our website, 21stshow.org, to find links for all the ways to contact us, as well as our podcast, or just search us out wherever you listen, The 21st Show. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.